Tonight's episode of the 31st Lap Podcast is brought to you by DirtTrackDigest.com. If it's on dirt, it's on Dirt Track Digest.
This is the 31st Lap Podcast, recorded live in the studios of FingerLakes1.com in downtown Seneca Falls, New York. And now, your host, Chris Marquardt.
Well, that was no good. An abrupt stop to that 31st lap on deck tonight. Going to be talking a little bit about all the goings on in motorsports around the country. We've got Stephen Ovens joining us from Black Rock Speedway. Steve, man, you got me?
Yeah, man, we're here. We're ready to rock.
All right. That's one change that we had to do. Make that a little bit louder so everybody can hear you. Are you there now?
Yeah, man, we're ready to rock and roll here on a Thursday night.
There we go. Everybody can hear you now. So we'll dive right into it. Big news breaking this week. Depends on which side of it you want to go. If you want to go sad or if you want to go sadder. The passing, untimely passing of one Buddy Baker. I mean, what an awesome dude that guy was for motorsports. We've seen him set a number of different marks in NASCAR. He's turned the fastest lap first person to go over 200 miles an hour. Did it in one of those Superbirds back in 1970. Finally got the monkey off his back, winning the still fastest Daytona 500 on record back in 1980. Was a guy that I grew up watching race at the twilight of his career, and then he turned directions and had an all-new showing when he was one of the commentators on TNN's broadcast of the NASCAR races, and guy that came to really like listening to, you know. He had that gentle delivery, man. He didn't really have a bad word to say, just real down home, easygoing commentary, and really made you feel like you were a part of the race.
Well, that's the thing about Buddy Baker is, you know, everybody has a Buddy Baker story, whether you are a part of the NASCAR scene or not, and like you. So you talk about his time on TNN, and I believe he also did some time on CBS. My only memory, his days behind the wheel were just a little bit before my time. But you know, to hear the stories that he could tell, and you know, actually in the last few years, I've got to listen to him quite a bit on the satellite NASCAR channel. Mm-hmm. You know, just a great guy that, you know, the term gentle giant is what everybody called him. And I think, you know, from everything that I've ever watched him on TV or heard on the radio, you know, that certainly described him well. And, you know, he's on that short list of guys that, you know, you could point to and say there's one of the good guys that's going to be sorely missed around the NASCAR scene for sure.
That's one of the things that we always come back to when these legends of racing, be it at the national level, like with Buddy Baker when they pass on, or whether it be like somebody that's a little bit closer to us, somebody like Jack Christensen. You know, when those guys pass, the history that goes with them and the stories that you don't know or that never got told, or at least never got told to the public forum so that you could hear them. I mean, can you just imagine that, you know, Buddy Baker's heyday was in the 70s when NASCAR was in some of their formative years. Winston had just gotten on board and created the Winston Cup and really had started generating things, more money, more backing, more exposure, and then it transitioned from 78, 79, and 80 when things started to get more on television and things like that, and you were able to watch Buddy Baker win a Daytona 500 in 1980 with, I believe that that point was the, I believe it was a Dygard car he was in, or one of the Yates cars. It was number 28 on the side. I remember that much. And it was just, can you imagine with the stories that he can take from being in the pit area? Think about Darrell Waltrip in his rookie year in 1979. Bobby Allison, one of the forces out there, getting to lock horns with somebody like Bobby Isaac. Richard Petty, obviously. Cal Yarborough in the mix of that as well.
Yeah, and you know, to kind of put that local tie on it like you did, Chris, you know, you think about some of the folks that have left us, you know, sooner than we would have liked here locally. You brought up Jack, and I'll throw in Doug Madison, as they were such a pair on the radio for such a long time. And it really, it really makes you appreciate, you know, those that you get to be around at the racetrack. And, you know, it's not a Friday night doesn't go by that sitting next to Mel Thomas, he doesn't bring up a Jack story of some kind. And I have learned, you know, over the last few seasons of, you know, either this season working alongside with Mel or in previous years working for him and Matt behind the camera, is just really, you know, enjoying the stories and really, you know, taking some of that and letting that hit home is, you know, what a great opportunity that we have to be able to go and do all these things that you get to do and take in. And, you know, it's just that those things, you can't really put a price on that.
Buddy Baker, the son of Buck Baker, he made his first NASCAR start at the age of 18. I mean, can you imagine being 18 years old and climbing into the car and racing against the guys of that era, and then turn around and moving on as a rookie, those guys, and then, you know, in his career prime, having to go against the cast of stars that he was against then. I mean, he had no easy road. It wasn't something where he won a ton of races or anything like that. He certainly won his share, but he didn't never got the accolades per se as somebody like Cal Yarborough or you know, Richard Petty dominated so much of the 70s, and there were some other champions interspersed there between those two. But even still, the championship eluded him. But still, you know, he was go ahead.
As you compare it to, you know, the racing now, I mean, that's almost like comparing somebody that races in our time now to, you know, racing with Jimmy Johnson. I mean, how many guys are going to go their career without a championship because they raced in the days of Kevin Harvick and Jimmy Johnson and Tony Stewart?
Sure. I mean, is there anybody now that you can make a comparison to, do you think, that would fit sort of that same, I don't know if it's even fair to call it a mold, but that same sort of mentality that Buddy Baker brought to the table, at least as a race driver?
Boy, that's a tough one.
He was a unique guy. You know what I mean? He wasn't anybody that was overtly outspoken. I mean, you can make the comparisons between Darrell Waltrip in some of his formative years in the 80s and some of the guys that you see now, like Tony Stewart. Even you could put those two side by side with the way they're outspoken and they don't care. I don't know if "don't care" is really the right way of saying it, but one of the guys that always struck me that sort of had a common thread with Buddy Baker was Jeff Burton, and Jeff Burton now transitioning into the commentator's booth.
That was the only person that I could really think of, and, you know, I think that even Jeff Burton is even a little bit more outspoken than Buddy was, but the thing that Buddy Baker had that I don't know that a lot of people could even do that, is he had a way of, you know, trying to explain something with the cars or setup or how the car's reacting in track. He had a way to bring it down so that, you know, even the basic NASCAR fan could understand that. I think Jeff Burton does just as well at that. But, you know, it takes a real unique and special person to be able to do that, to take somebody that's not familiar with the sport and try and bring something down to their level so that they can kind of say, hey, I get it. I understand now.
Larry McReynolds desperately tries to do that, but it always seems like he ends up talking over my head.
Well, yeah, that's true. It sometimes for the crew chief, I imagine it's a little bit more difficult. But I'll tell you, talking crew chief, I'm sure maybe part of this is because of his years working with my favorite driver, but I could just sit and listen to Steve Letarte all day long explaining strategy, and I think that he is such a great fit for TV. But, you know, he's another one of those guys that I think can really bring it down to your level so that you understand.
Did we inadvertently miss a generation of commentators? When you think about what you were just saying about Buddy Baker and the way that he can bring things down to the most layman level, you know, another guy that came up through about the same time in some of that commentary stuff, maybe a little bit of lead time on Buddy Baker, was Ned Jarrett. And I think he had a lot of those same qualities. And is that a lost art, so to say? I mean, the person that pops into my mind as we were talking here is Andy Petrie. He does a really, really nice job in terms of taking the technicalities of NASCAR racing, which is far, far more technical now than it was back when Buddy Baker was racing, and even more so than when Ned Jarrett was in his heyday. So in order to translate what's going on in the cars and bring it down to a level where you can sort of understand it, I think he does a pretty good job. And Darrell Hammond as well in those special cutaway segments that they have now on some of those NASCAR broadcasts. They do a decent job, but it's almost now, you know, in hindsight looking back on it, like we forgot to appreciate how good those guys were.
Yeah, and the thing that Petrie always brought to it, too, is, you know, not only the crew chief level, but also, I mean, his time as a car owner. And you look at his time as a car owner, and that wasn't exactly a thriving team. I think one of probably their best days was, you know, running 2 and 3 behind Earnhardt at Talladega. And, you know, I always appreciated his perspective there because he's not just... doesn't have just one facet of the sport. He served as a crew chief that was kind of, you know, the head coach of the team, you know, making calls and doing the strategy and things of that sort. But then, you know, later in his career, you know, taking the car owner side of it too. So you're right on with that, with Andy Petrie for sure.
So we're throwing a lot of names around here in terms of the broadcast side of things. I mean, Ricky Craven could probably jump into that discussion. Dale Jarrett as well. Darrell Waltrip, he goes airs to the side of loose cannon sometimes when he's on there. But at the same time, he can explain a little bit about what the drivers are going through. Do you have, per se, is there a dream team, so to say, of a group of guys that you'd like to hear all work together in the same race?
You know, I really appreciate the history and the way that Mike Joy can, you know, he can dump off to the driver and the crew chief and let them talk about specifics. But Mike Joy, to me, is the guy that's always been able to, okay, we'll take that detailed information, let's bring it back, and here's what the whole picture looks like. Mm-hmm. You know, broadly, this is what's going on. So I think for me, I really think a dream team for me would have been Mike Joy. And, you know, since how we're talking about him, I really think Buddy Baker is in that group. And again, like I said before, for crew chief, I really enjoy what we're seeing so far out of Steve Letarte. So I think that'd be my dream team right now.
I think Alan Bestwick's got to get in there. You got to give him a job someplace, even if you make him run up and down pit road with his perfect air.
No doubt.
And I think I'd put Alan Bestwick in the booth, probably with Ned Jarrett and maybe with Andy Petrie, and keep Darrell Hammond down there on the infield for breakaway analysis.
You know, there's so many names that you couldn't go wrong with, no matter how you lined them up. But yeah, I mean, the team that you just named, I mean, that could easily be anybody's dream team there for sure.
Don't put Kenny Wallace in any spot where he talks for more than 5 minutes, though. Kenny's an awesome dude, but I mean, can you imagine if you had somebody like Mike Joy or Chris Economaki, right? They're in control of the broadcast. They're your main play-by-play guy. To his left is Darrell Waltrip. To his right is Kenny Wallace.
That would really be interesting. I enjoy hearing Kenny. You know, I think the where they have him is perfect. They, you know, you get little 2, 3, maybe 5 minute sound bites at a time. Boy, I don't know for a whole race. That would really be interesting.
I've wondered why Kyle Petty doesn't get more involved with. I mean, certainly it's a position that he chooses to be in. He does a great job on there, and little by little, he's become more and more outspoken. Even at times, coming out and being quite public with some of his conflicts with the 43 team here, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. But how do you think he would do in that race day setting with what we've got now?
Well, I think...
I mean, I think he's done it before, Beck. I think he was one of the in race day analysis for TNT at one point.
Yeah, and what's interesting about Kyle is I think, and this is, would just be my opinion, but I think that what is great and what would maybe make an executive producer cringe is the same thing for Kyle, and that's that outspoken, maybe, you know, to the point where maybe, you know, he's ruffled a few feathers in his past on air or out in public with comments. So, yeah, I mean, I think he would be, I really enjoy listening to him post-race, and I can't recall if he does a lot of pre-race, but you know, we listened to him quite a bit in the media center at Watkins Glen Sunday with his post-race comments, and I really thought that all his points were spot on, but like I said, I think what makes him great and what makes an executive producer cringe is probably, you know, maybe why we don't see him up top in the booth calling a race.
Kyle Petty shared the track a couple instances with one Buddy Baker, another guy that had the chance to do likewise coming through the 80s when he was just cutting his teeth. Rusty Wallace doing the same thing, and now he's joined some of the infield analysis staffs for the race breakaways. How do you feel Rusty has done in terms of transitioning to the microphone away from the steering wheel?
I enjoy Rusty's commentary. I think he's a pretty good fit of both, you know, useful information. I mean, we talked about, you know, Darrell Waltrip kind of, you know, he's kind of on the one end of the spectrum, and you know, maybe you put Buddy Baker, more calm, relaxed, cool, collected kind of guy on the other end. But I think Rusty can put some energy and, you know, some real passion into his commentary. And I think he's a good mix of both. And, you know, I think I'd put him right in the middle. You know, if you're looking at a scale of Buddy Baker to Darrell Waltrip, you know, Rusty's right there in the middle. Always has good information, and at the right times is always willing to put in a, you know, some passion and energy into what he's saying.
I got nothing against a guy like Rusty Wallace, but I don't really like listening to him on TV. I don't know what it is. I just it's just not where Ricky Craven is a guy I love to listen to. I mean, it seems like they always go to Ricky Craven when, like you just illustrated there, where there's these two extremes, and then they cut to Ricky Craven for the voice of reason. I mean, you ever watch ESPN, and he's there, he's the guy that's the steady, even keel voice of reason. He's like, all right, everybody calm down, and let's look at this pragmatically, and kind of takes all sides and gives you, you know, takes all these extremes and puts together as close to the truth as you're going to get.
If you've ever been fired up about anything at a NASCAR race, just listen to Ricky Craven talk about it. He'll talk you right off the ledge.
Hopefully not right to sleep. No?
I wouldn't say that.
No, okay. Whew, got nervous there. I gotta say, one of my favorite finishes in NASCAR, I know it's modern era stuff, but him and Kurt Busch going for the win at Darlington when Ricky was in the Tide car and Kurt was driving the Sharpie car for Roush Racing. That was such a good finish.
Yeah, you don't see that quite as much anymore, and you know, maybe that's why the competition is, you know, not quite at the level of what it was at the time that finish took place. But yeah, I mean. And that's a video clip there that, until NASCAR folds up and is no longer, you know, in existence, that's always going to be on any top 10 finish show, without a doubt. You know, even if it's only number 10, that is always going to be, that's always going to be on there.
Well, I mean, that's one of them that you see put right alongside, and you're comparing some vastly different eras. But the 76 Daytona 500 and the 79 Daytona 500 with David Pearson and Richard Petty wrecking in 76 to come across the line, and Petty stalls the car. David Pearson keeps his clutch in and keeps his car running to limp it across. and then from 79 where they got the fight in turn three and Richard Petty comes around to win the 500 that year, well ahead of Darrell Waltrip. And those are two of them that are right there that are indelible marks in NASCAR history, and that finish with Kurt Busch and Ricky Craven just as poignant. We talked about big finishes and stuff like that. Had a pretty good weekend over there at Black Rock Speedway this weekend, didn't you?
Yeah, it was really really a great night. The annual MRO night. MRO was fortunate enough to have Trevor Bayne be willing to put his name on the event, and of course he's a former winner of the event, and it was just it was really, really cool. I was trying to think back. I don't know, for one reason or another, I don't really know how many of these MRO nights I have even been able to take in. Certainly, this was the first one for me in probably 4 or 5 years at least. And to see these guys out there, and David Ragan won the celebrity match race, but to see him, I mean, he was really getting after it in Tyler Series Modified. Charging into turn one and through the apex of the corner. A couple of times he even, took the left front wheel and climbed up on, it's a small incline now. Really charging the corners hard just really, really, really great to see those guys out there having a good time. We did have a mix of sportsman modifieds and a couple guys, including the winner, Reagan, was in a small block modified. So he certainly had a horsepower advantage, but early on in the event, Reagan and Bayne, who was driving Brady Foltz's Crate Sportsman, they were, in turns three and four in particular, Bayne would pull a slide job into turn three, Reagan would cut the wheel down low, cross him over, and take the lead down the straightaway. They did that for two or three laps in a row. For just a 12-lap exhibition, they put on a great show. Jaron Zimbardi picked up a win with the Patriot Sprint Tour. He had an incredible battle with Brian Howland. I feel like the last couple of races at Black Rock, you see, different guys will lead pieces of a race at a time, but these guys were going back and forth, until Howland had a mechanical problem and dropped out of the race, and then Zimbardi pulled away from there. But that was a great race. The modified feature, Tyler Seary picked up the win. He led after everybody stacked up in turn one and two. We only had two cars that missed the accident on the opening lap, so nice. Had them stacked up pretty good there. But all the cars got to restart except so had a good modified race the other night. All across the board, street stock race came down to the last lap. The four-cylinder race actually came down to the last lap as well.
Not exactly. Not exactly. it was a good race on the track, but you can't do the restarts that way, and Rich Sarpstein ends up penalized two spots. There was no stoppage between his infraction and the end of the race, and he was docked two spots, whether he crossed the line first or not.
Yeah, and I guess what I was referring to was, the cars on track running second and third didn't realize that they were racing for the lead, but right. They were side-by-side coming off of four to take the checkers, and, it was... They didn't realize that they were racing for the win at that point in time, but it was really something else. Steve Gray and the Crate Sportsman picked up a win. He's been red hot lately. Picked up the Grit win on Tuesday night last week, and then won Friday night with the features only format. So yeah, it was a really good night. We had a couple of delays. That you expect on MRO night. We didn't lose the lights, which I guess has been kind of a yearly thing on MRO night for whatever reason. The lights are always an issue, but we didn't have any problems there. but we still got everybody out by 11:30, and with all of the events taking place, and you take a lot of time to interview the top five drivers in the celebrity race, I really thought that overall it was a great night. Our promoter, Mike Jackson, was real happy with things. The folks from MRO were very pleased, and importantly, I think the fans really enjoyed the show. I've gotten a lot of positive feedback this week.
Is there anybody that's working on it really at any level? You know, be it NASCAR broadcasting, like we talked about a few minutes ago, or anybody that's working at the various tracks now that you sort of looked up to, that you said that's the kind of guy that eventually I want to talk like, or took some cues and learned how to be smooth or relaxed after you watched him or her for X amount of time?
Well, I think the guy that goes to the top of the list is Chris Marquardt.
But, oh, come on. Get out of here.
You know, you got to remember, you asked me that question once before, and I got it wrong, so I wanted to make sure I answered it.
That's true. Very true.
You know, as far as NASCAR guys go,
doesn't have to be. I mean,
yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure that I could really give too much of an answer there. I mean, I feel like I've tried to kind of learn the ropes, and this year learn the ropes kind of as I've gone along, from guys that, you know, I grew up listening to or listened to when I was at the racetrack myself. So, you know, in my time growing up and learning things, I mean, there was the period of time that you were the announcer at Black Rock, Rich Black. And even, honestly, this year I've even learned, you know, I've never worked alongside Mel in the booth before. I mean, I've shot races for him behind the camera for years, but, you know, it's totally different when you're trying to produce, you know, whether it was a multi-camera race or whatever. It's all different from producing to sitting behind the mic and trying to put on a good show for the fans and you know, relate to them everything that's happening. So, but I don't know if I could really pinpoint one in particular.
Steve Payne's leading the points over there.
Yeah, and, you know, I'll be honest with you, if you would have told me that at like week five, that he was going to be leading by the end of the season, I probably would have told you, sure, there's a chance that could happen, but, you know, to have the lead that he has now, I don't know that I would have agreed with you at that point, because they had a terrible start to the season. You know, a couple of mechanical failures that didn't allow them to even start a feature, and, you know, when you don't start the feature, and the guys that were leading the points are scoring, you know, 30 points, 25 points, depending on where they finish, you know, that put them in a hole for quite a while. But here about mid-season, he was able to take over the point lead, and lately it's just been survival and getting those top fives on the nights when, you know, the car's banged up a little bit, and, you know, has gotten caught in a couple of jingles that were really not of his doing. And it's on those nights when he's pulled in a fourth-place finish or a third-place finish. That's really gotten Steve to where he's at now. And with as many championships as he has at Canandaigua, you know, he's used to that. You know, he's always been able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some of the other guys have had their struggles as the season wore on. Cartwright had an engine go a couple weeks ago. Derek Pozziadlo, who I thought has been due for a win for a while now, has had some, you know, some bad breaks with accidents. One week engine let go while he was leading a race. So, you know, those guys have kind of run into their bad luck as the seasons wore on, where Steve kind of got it out of the way early in the season.
It's always fun to watch those points races as they shake out. A couple local ones getting ready to round into form. Labor Day generally is the cutoff point. Matt Shepard coming away with another top five showing over Brewerton behind Matt Fink. Matt Fink winning for the first time since 2011. Nice win for Matt over there. And Sheppard only has 2 points in hand over Jimmy Phelps in the chase. Over there, Ab Roots and Billy Decker, 38 points off the pace. Darrell Lewis, he won for the first time in over a year in the 61st anniversary event over at Spencer Speedway. Lewis held off Mike Lady and Andy Lewis in the 61-lap affair. Barrett Shank won the Super Sixes. Timmy Catalano in the four cylinders, winning once again. Those guys talking about over at Spencer Speedway that Richie Evans is going to be added to the Watkins Glen Walk of Fame coming up this September. You have to race in a modified at that track, or race in a vehicle at that track in order to be eligible. He ran a modified there back in 1976. It's open to any driver, as we said, who participated over there. Spencer's also got some news out already about their banquet. Nothing like rushing it. November the 21st, plan there, $30 each. Contact Lee DeRitter. Oswego Speedway, they had their 65th anniversary event at Oswego. Michael Muldoon winning the 45-lapper there. Mike Bond won the Small Block Supers event. They've got this Saturday, kind of a neat deal. I don't know if you followed up on this. Teal Palace instead of the Steel Palace. Ovarian Cancer Awareness Night is coming up Saturday. 50-lap super modified feature, 30-lap small block feature. Driver autograph session at 5:15. Heats roll off at 6:30. They're going to have raffles. There's a quilt made of racing t-shirts. Teal Palace t-shirts are going to be on sale. And then a number of cars are carrying decals that say, Teal, there's a cure. Pits open at 2 o'clock. OswegoSpeedway.com for more details on that. Steve, you referenced Canandaigua with Justin Harris picking up his third win of the year. Michael Bryan looked like he had one in hand until Justin was able to run him down. He took second ahead of Vic Coffey, Dave Raji, Chad Holman coming home in the fifth spot. Dave Marcicelli winning the sportsman feature. Dave Ferguson took the 305. Lee Sanders, former guest here on the 31st lap, coming away with a top three finish. Steve Pasarek took his fifth street stock feature. Eric Chapman, again, the top performer in the pure stock race. Harris, 8 points behind Sheppard in the season point chase there at Canandaigua Speedway. Sheppard has 8 wins and 14 starts. I kind of thought with 8 wins he was going to be further ahead than that, but Harris has been plenty consistent, stay within striking distance. Gary Tompkins, he's got a couple wins. He's 41 points off the pace. Tim Fuller, Chad Holman sitting in the top five. Over at Fulton Speedway, Danny Johnson took the win over Jimmy Phelps and Larry White. His 2 wins put him fourth overall in the track point standings. Billy Decker, having won twice, is leading. Five-time winner Larry White is next, but he's been up and down, 74 points behind the pace. Decker has been in the top five 11 times, 13 starts, and hasn't missed the top 10. White, not quite as consistent, 8 top fives, meaning only 3 times outside of that was he in the top 10, missing top 10 a couple times in his 13 starts. Looking at the Tour, Matt Sheppard, the Tour points leader for the Super Dirt Car Series, he won the Hall of Fame 100 over at Weedsport, taking $10,000 home for his effort. Jimmy Phelps, Tim Fuller followed. Pat Ward and Eric Rudolph filled the top five. Sheppard has an 85-point lead over Jimmy Phelps in the Tour standings. Decker, Hearn, Danny Johnson, right close together. And they ran last night over at Albany Saratoga. Big Show 7 was on deck for them. Mitch Brown won the ESS stop at Ashwiken Speedway. And Steve Poirier picked up the win over at Canandaigua on Saturday night. And that car that he's been driving is a 5-year-old Eagle, if you can believe that. Technology overlooking the Eagle. It's been clipped and bent and bruised, but never enough to be junked, and he's still showing him how it's done. 52 wins now for Poirier as he chases Mike Woodring's record of 59 wins in the ESS ranks. He's also chasing his 6th title. Jason Barney was second ahead of Mike Stelter, Matt Tanner, and Sean Donath. So, on the topic of Canandaigua, on the topic of sprint cars, we have a particular anniversary that I don't know if anybody really wants to celebrate, but that event serves as the 1-year repeat of the timely passing of Kevin Ward. Odd timing with the family's decision in conjunction with Watkins Glen weekend that they have now decided to bring a civil suit against Tony Stewart. And we've been tracking this a little bit, and things now getting ugly as more and more fact come to light about the state, I guess you could say. I guess we really don't know for sure, other than going off of toxicology reports, enough of marijuana residue left in young Kevin Ward's system to justify an opinion of impairment. And things spiraling downhill quickly. Steven, you got any thoughts on how this thing's playing out?
Well, at this point, I just think it's unfortunate. It was, in my opinion, it was bad enough to you know, have gone through the loss that the family went through last year. You know, there's not a lot of people that, you know, can say that they, you know, the classic saying of we understand how you feel. And there's only a certain number of people that can actually say that, unfortunately. But, you know, I wasn't really a big fan of the timing of the announcement of the lawsuit. Knowing that there was a 2-year window in which they could file the suit, I didn't think it certainly went to help them any with, you know, fan supports or anything of that sort with the timing. And I think now that this is going, you know, now that he's, you know, civil suit's been filed, I really, like you said, some of the details are going to come out, and some of them are a little bit ugly. I think that's unfortunate because, you know, we don't have to be in this place. We are, and there's nothing you can do about it now. But
well, nothing you do is going to bring Kevin Ward back either.
Right, right.
You know, that's probably the most telling thing right now, and I kind of believe that, given some of these details as they come out, Stephen, we're looking at some issues here. You know, first and foremost, I don't think that Tony Stewart's going to be real quick to come behind the courthouse and throw a bunch of money at this, because in the court of public opinion, that's going to be an admission of guilt, and I have a hard time pinning sole responsibility on Tony Stewart. I know that's probably not the most popular opinion to take on it, but there's a litany of bad decisions that led us to this position. There's all these armchair analysts that are coming out that are watching video, analyzing it down to, you know, 1/20th speed, and saying that they can see the car rock. You know, it's a sprint car. It weighs what, 1,200 pounds, and has 800 horsepower. If you turn it to the left, it's gonna rock to the right. It's just the way that thing's made. It's gonna lay over. So you can't. Are you going to sit here and tell me definitively that a cruising speed of 35 or 40 miles an hour, whatever it might have been when they were going through turn two, that you can definitively say that Kevin Ward grabbed hold of that wing? I don't know. Did Kevin Ward come out of the blocks with something to prove because it was Tony Stewart? I doubt that. I mean, come on. Because it was Tony Stewart? No. The reason was because he was a racer, and that's what you do when, you know. Unfortunately, there's this unwritten man code. And racing, and you working at a Friday night track, Steve, and going to all the races that you have through the time, you know what I'm talking about here, is that if you're wronged on the track, it doesn't matter who or how much money they have, you're going to attempt to voice your opinion. And sometimes that spills over to a point where individuals leave their car unwisely and approach oncoming traffic. That happens. That happens in NASCAR, for God's sakes. And you can see it on national television at any given instance on a particular Sunday during the course of the regular season.
Yeah, no, you're right, and you know that's the thing that, you know, that's kind of over the years, and this is not just a recent thing. I mean, that's kind of become the culture. Is, you know, when you feel you've been wronged, you take care of it because you don't want to wait and take a chance that, you know, the track officials aren't going to not take care of it, or maybe they'll take care of it and you won't think, well, how they took care of it, you know what I mean? It's just
right.
That's kind of how things go, I guess. But yeah, I mean, like you said, there's just a series of, you know, unfortunate events and decisions made on how to handle things that, you know, got us to this point. And, you know, honestly, the frustrating part to watch and see all the commentary that's taken place is the fact that, you know, all of these things were what made us just want this whole situation to go away last summer. You know, now with this lawsuit coming out, now everything, you know, it just rips the scab right off of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like at some point you have people that are trying to retry the case that was already heard.
Right.
And nothing came, you know, the grand jury did not have any recommendations. So
they didn't indict.
You know, to try and retry that case, whether it's on social media or at the water cooler, I mean, there's no point to that right now. I mean, that part's been settled, but now
Tell me if you disagree. Tell me if you disagree with this. That the reason why so many people right now are passionate about this situation with Tony Stewart is the same reason why overnight Dale Earnhardt Jr. suddenly inherited a throng of fans when Dale Earnhardt Sr. passed away at Daytona. It's passion, right? I mean, do you agree with me on that?
Yeah. Yep, I do.
It's the same situation. You either love Tony Stewart and he's innocent as a nun, or he is the absolute devil because you hate him and he did this on purpose. I'm struggling to find a lot of people that are willing to occupy that middle ground where there's contributory negligence on everybody's side. Did Kevin Ward get out of the car and approach an oncoming car? Yes, he did. Was he wearing a dark fire suit? Yes, he did. Did it match his car? Well, yeah, it did, just like every other driver out there. Likewise, did Tony Stewart maybe try and push him back a little bit using his motor? You know, rev the motor a little bit, tell him, hey, back off a little bit, something along those lines. Is that a plausible reality? Yeah, I think it is. Was he trying to run him over? I highly doubt that. The question that I want to have an answer to, that I don't think anybody has answered yet, that if instead of Tony Stewart, Chuck Hebing, Steve Poirier, Lance Young, pick one, Brian Holland, Jason Barney, if one of those individuals were the guy to have hit Kevin Ward, or at least had a contributing role in the unfortunate death of Kevin Ward at Canandaigua Motorsports Park, not would it be in national news. That question's already been asked a million times. Would there be the wrongful? Would there still be the civil suit being levied against that driver now?
In my opinion, Chris, that if it is any of those other drivers, we're not even sitting here talking about this. In my opinion, we're not here talking about it.
Yeah, I'm kind of leaning that way. I mean, as much as I hate to say it that way, I'm kind of thinking that this would be maybe a highlight on local news, and that would be the end of it. And we'll get into that. We'll get into that healing and the scarring thing here in a little bit with some of the stuff that went on at Canandaigua this weekend, with some of the news of Jeremy Corcoran stepping down as well, that you and I traded some messages with earlier today. But moreover, coming back to this whole, you know, who is, what if, all this other stuff. I mean, you've got the lighting situation over in Turn 2, but everybody knows that. That has been a situation at Canandaigua for years. It, just because it's that way doesn't make that it's right. But I heard one argument where, how was Tony Stewart, you know, hang on with this for me with this one, because this was heavy. How is it that Tony Stewart, now, this is after the argument was made that Kevin Ward was trying to make a name for himself by going after Tony Stewart, who has millions of dollars, and trying to bull Tony Stewart, yada, 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 whatever. How would Tony Stewart know that Kevin Ward was there, given that he's driving a sprint car? Not talking about him exiting the car. Instead, talking prior to that, when the two were running side by side over there in turn number two. How would Tony Stewart know? I think that's a really ignorant argument because these guys are racers. You know, all of them are racers. When you have somebody up on your outside, you have somebody underneath you, you know that they're there because you have seat feel. It's because you have peripheral vision. I get the whole downboard on the sail panel on the right side. It occludes vision and stuff like that, but you still have ears. You can't tell me how many interviews have you heard where second place is gaining on first, or whatever position it is where somebody has a remarkable run and they say, well, I could hear him, but I didn't know how high in the groove or how close he was, but I could hear him. You can't tell me that they didn't hear one another given the proximity that they're racing at. They were in 360 sprint cars. They're not exactly the quietest cars on the track. I just thought that I thought that element of the argument was sort of over the top. I mean, that was one of them that I looked at that and was like, wow, have you ever It's just it was one of them that had some serious holes in it. I'm sure that they were both aware of where one another was, and you can trick this thing off as it's just one of those racing deals. It's just one of those this. It's just one of those that. You know, at the end of the day, there's some pretty serious outcomes that everybody was really in the racing community struggled a little bit to deal with, and I don't think anybody's looking forward to this weekend. But I think everybody was probably equally surprised by the response on Saturday to the anniversary weekend, and equally the news breaking of the civil suit. There was no, as I'm hearing, reported by multiple places now, there was no moan of silence or mention in any way of Kevin Ward at Canandaigua Motorsports Park.
Yeah, I was not there myself, so I can't speak from first person, but I actually, Sunday, we were taking a look at a piece that Bob Pockris did for ESPN, and you know, there was officials quoted in there saying that, you know, they forewent that, you know, in an effort to not, you know, kind of rip the scab off the wound and upset people and things like that. But, you know, it's hard not to sit back and think, you know, with everything from Friday afternoon on that occurred.
Now, hang on a second. Hang on. I gotta call a flag on this one. We don't want to rip the wound out. What about all the Tony Stewart shirts that were handed out? Was there any mention of that in the story?
I did read that, but I don't believe that was part of the article. No.
Okay. Because I'm getting the same folks that are telling me about the lack of moment of silence also said that there was ample Tony Stewart memorabilia handed out in the stands. So the whole official saying we don't want to rip the scab off, sort of interesting timing. Could be just free stuff from Smoke. I mean, we talked about MRO, Shemung had a Spalding Foundation fundraiser, things like that. That often happens this weekend. For a long time, the Spalding Foundation was at Black Rock Speedway. Now they're over at Shemung. MRO is in over there at Black Rock. It could have been any combination of elements, but it's interesting the decision.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. You know, the combination of the two, and again, you know, it's I don't want to sit here tonight and point fingers or call anybody out on any of those actions. But, I mean, when you sit back and you look at all of the different pieces that were in play, it does make you kind of sit back and think about it, because, you know, there was really no mention about it. The Tony Stewart T-shirts were in, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of pieces to it, Chris, for sure.
It's interesting. I had a family member of one of the racers had told me that. I mean, who knows? It could have been somebody from Tony Stewart Racing that just got out of the inside and decided to hand out a bunch of T-shirts because they were at Canandaigua, not even registering the thought of Kevin Ward. But all the same, it's interesting. Canandaigua is going to be going through a little bit of a transition period now with the news coming out that Jeremy Corcoran electing to step down. His wife's still going to stay on staff. He's going to finish out the year, everything like that, but justifiably. I mean, the guy's done a great job at turning Canandaigua around, and I can completely see where he would be approaching burnout. Did a lot of stuff to make Canandaigua one of the prolific places to race, and keeping it on that forefront and carrying the torch after Dirt Motorsports and Jeff Farney ran it for a long time. Well-deserved break, I think it's fair to say. I mean, Jeremy's done a really, really nice job over there. The sportsman division flourishing. You see, the street stock division has enjoyed a little bit of a resurgence. The modified racing over there has been absolutely top notch. Matt Shepard certainly enjoyed the tenure of Jeremy Corcoran, enjoying a lot of success over there. His team really, really rounding into form and etching his name into the record books with Indelible Ink. at Canandaigua Motorsports Park. So Jeremy electing to take a little bit of leave of absence. But yeah, over the weekend there was some there was a lot of funky stuff, and for the position to be taken that we're trying to not add hurt or rip the scab off of it, as in so many words, it certainly made a lot of people look at it and wonder, and by proxy, I think it brought up a lot of hurt nonetheless.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you talk about, you know, Jeremy wanting to step aside from the track. I mean, I'm sure the timing of everything is got to be, you know, when I had a chance to speak with him and do an interview at the Motorsports Expo, I thought it was very telling, you know, what he told us about the fact that, you know, he carried so much, you know, he felt like he carried so much responsibility and hurt over what happened last year that, you know, I can't imagine what, you know, he has to think, you know, every day. I mean, that's something, just like with Tony and just like with the Ward family, and that's something that he's going to carry with him every day. And between that and all of the hard work he's put into the Speedway, and then, you know, the announcement of the civil suit on Friday, you know, I think it was just his time to need to step back. And I think it's unfortunate, because I think Canandaigua is a much better place with Jeremy at the helm there. He has brought that place from when we didn't know what the future of Canandaigua was going to be. I mean, you think back, there was a time where some folks thought, is Canandaigua going to turn into what Weedsport was for years, until Al Hanke and Jimmy Phelps came along?
Right.
I remember the talk about that.
Or worse yet,
Canandaigua going to turn into that.
Or worse yet,
and that close, was when Jeremy stepped in.
Close entirely and turn into an apartment complex.
Yeah.
You know, that's...
So it's going to be an interesting transition. I know that, you know, from everybody that I have spoken to, you know, it sounds like most of their officials are going to be in place as normal. So hopefully it can be business as usual for them. Certainly a huge task that needs to be crossed off the to-do list in that transition is the maintenance of the track.
Right. Jeremy did a little bit of that.
Yeah. So, and that's going to be a hard transition, because, you know, when you talk about, you know, the racing surface and the quality racing, I mean, it doesn't get a lot better than what you see at Canandaigua every Saturday night. So, you know, not only do you need to find somebody who can manicure the track, but you want to try and get it as just as good as Jeremy did it, and that's going to be a tall task for whoever takes over that role. So,
sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be tough, but I know that Greg Emerson, who's been with Jeremy for a few years now at Canandaigua, is certainly capable of managing the people alongside Lori and you know, trying to get some of those resources put into place. You know, so that's you know, I hope that gives the racers some confidence there. But yeah, they've got quite a transition here.
And that's not to say that Jeremy's going away forever. He's just at this point just kind of taking a bit of a break, which we're a couple weeks from the end of the season. Who knows? He could come back in 2016, re-energized, refocused, and ready to attack the Land of Legends once again. You were talking about the great racing and all the stuff like that over at Canandaigua Motorsports Park. Nonetheless, Black Rock Speedway enjoying quite a bit of good racing, and the Bandits, the future of the racing division over there at Black Rock, now taking center stage again this Friday.
Yeah, really excited about that. You know, we put together a 15-lap special for them this week. a couple weeks ago, I had an opportunity to interview one of the drivers for a feature that we put on the track website, and I asked her, one of the questions was, you know, what's the hardest part of trying to, you know, wheel your car around the track, you know, what, and just asking, you know, is it a particular corner, is it, you know, racing with in traffic or what, and she said that, you know, the thing that she struggled with the most was that they don't get a lot of track time.
Sure.
So, you know, it kind of popped an idea, well, hey, let's give them a few more laps and run a special. Let's, you know, let's let these kids out there and see what they can do. So we're adding 5 laps this week for a 15-lap special. And I think the more important piece is we're going to, after their hot lap session, it's tradition that they go into the pit area, make their final adjustments with the mom and dad and the crew, and then we do the national anthem, and then they come out to do their 10-lap feature right off the bat, beginning of the night. And what we're going to do this week is, after their hot laps, we're actually going to let them go in, make a quick adjustment, whatever they need to do. Then we're going to bring them on the front stretch. We're going to line them up. We're going to get the drivers out of the car, get their helmets off, and allow the crowd to be introduced to each driver. You know, on a normal week, the only time you get to meet any of the Bandit drivers is whoever's in Victory Lane. And, you know, Jeff Torrey has been in Victory Lane 12 times this season. So there hasn't been too much of an opportunity for some of the other drivers to, you know, get their face seen out there in Victory Lane and out there to the crowd. So it's going to be a neat opportunity for the crowd to meet all the drivers there in the Bandit division. And, you know, it's really kind of, it's really fun to look back in the history of the division. You know, we're coming up, I think this is, you know, the 16th year now that the Bandits have been, 16th or 17th year.
Something like that.
That the division's been at the Speedway. So it's pretty incredible to look back at what Lynn and Cindy Huff put together back when they owned and promoted the Speedway.
Erica Bell, who ended up winning her first of the year, first in a long time, in the four-cylinder division on Friday night. She ran in that compact, or the in the youth division over there. And you've got a number of guys who are in action now. I think Vern Knickerbocker is still racing over there at Black Rock. He came out of that that Bandit division and eventually moved on into the four-cylinders. John Wallenbeck, another guy. I think I want to say Ray Spiker.
Yeah, Ray Spiker is one.
He came out of it. I mean, Matt Shepard and Brady Foltz both having raced in that youth division before moving on to their current spots in fame.
Yeah, I mean, the list really goes on of guys that have come out of, you know, running the Bandit division at the track. And when you sit down and try, you know, when I wrote that press release, trying to think of some of the names and what they've done, whether it was at the Speedway or you look at, you know, Matt. I mean, Matt, what Matt has done is just off the charts.
He's done okay.
Wow, he came, you know, this is where he got his start, yep. In a full-size car anyway. I mean, he was quite a shoe in a go-kart as well, but as far as, you know, full-size car, you know, that was where he started. And it's pretty incredible to look back at that history. But yeah, I mean, and it just goes to show that, you know, this program works. It's no different than any local tracks that, you know, like look at Ransomville, they have their go-kart program. Mm-hmm. You look at Oswego Speedway, they have, I think their go-kart track out behind the backstretch grandstand, I think that's the fastest growing go-kart facility probably across the state. I mean, mm-hmm. to see, you know, their fields going from maybe 30, 40 carts to well over 100 go-karts every Friday night at Oswego is just incredible. And it shows that, you know, they have just as many youngsters that come out of the go-karts that are now racing on the big track.
Right.
You know, without you know, that entry, you know, to get, you know, A, to get kids interested in auto racing, and particularly, you know, for us, dirt track racing. But then, you know, to kind of get them exposed to it and get them interested and then wanting to keep going with it. You know, we say right in the article, it's the future of dirt track racing, and it's the future at our track. So it's such an important division to have there, and to put them in the spotlight is just a no-brainer.
You guys tried to do this a couple weeks ago, didn't you?
I'm sorry?
You guys tried to do this a couple weeks ago, didn't you? Give them the extra five laps, but didn't that event get rained out or canceled or shuffled around or something? I seem to remember the pressure.
There was about a month or two ago, we had suffered a rain out, and one of their feature actually kind of due to the impact, the incoming weather and us trying to push the show along, we ended up having to cut their feature that mm-hmm. night before the rain came, and so we did give them a few extra laps the following Friday night. I can't remember if that was 12 or 13 laps, but this will be the first time that we've given them 15. And actually, over the course of the history of the class, I'm not sure if they've ever run 15 laps before. So I think we might even be making a little bit of history on Friday night. It'll be interesting because, you know, they put on a pretty good show for 10 laps. And I think it'll be interesting to see what happens with 15. So
we'll be anxious to await it. The Modifieds on the program, Sportsman, Street Stocks, also joining the card, AMC Modifieds, and then the four-cylinder division as well. Black Rock Speedway race time at 7 o'clock? 7:30, I forget now.
7 o'clock.
7 yep. o'clock.
Hot laps take off at 6:15, and we're actually planning on the national anthem right at 7 o'clock. On the front stretch, we actually have the... we have a local singer from a band that's coming to do the national anthem live for us on Friday night. So that'll be a little something special as well.
Awesome. Well, man, I'm glad you're around. Always good talking to you. You're in Buffalo tonight, you said?
Yeah. My job that pays the light bill has brought me to Buffalo this week, and the next couple of weeks I'll be out here working Monday through Friday. So, been out to Maine and a couple other states here recently, but the one good thing about working in Buffalo during the week is I'm guaranteed to be home on the weekends to go dirt track racing. So
can't argue with that.
Thanks very much.
Will you be safe with your travels?
All right. Thanks a lot, Chris. Always appreciate the time being on the show with you.
Oh, yeah. No problem, man. I'm glad you're around. I think we're going to wrap it up for this week. It was a quick hour, wasn't it? I mean, that thing went by quick.
It did go by quick. Yes, it did. No doubt.
Well, as always, thanks a lot for coming on. Good luck this weekend. Hopefully everything goes smooth. Everybody stays safe, and you have a good time calling that race with Mel.
Absolutely. Appreciate it again, guys.
You bet. We'll catch up with you soon. There goes Stephen Ovens, Public Relations Director from Black Rock Speedway. That's going to do it for this edition of the 31st Lap. We appreciate you coming and tuning in, hanging out with us for a little while as you talk about all sorts of different elements of motorsports and the Finger Lakes and on the national level. We'll be back here again next week talking a little bit more of it. Hopefully we'll get to catch up with Mike and John here at some point. Mike is at Knoxville this weekend, taking the week off, and wishing the best in his travels. I saw he gave a nice gift to his parents, getting them a Hall of Fame seat right outside Knoxville, so they could take in the races and enjoy that activity over there. So you guys have a great time. Everybody, get out, support your local racetrack, and we'll see you right back here next week.
Finger Lakes 1.